Hello, everybody. Well, that song that we've just heard is taken from a biblical verse. It was based on Isaiah chapter 6, verse 8. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and whom will go for us?" And I said, "Here I am, send me." Well, in 1995, I had what I call an Isaiah 6:8 experience. I heard God calling. My husband Robert and I had high-powered careers, but Robert was always working away from home quite a lot, and I was bringing home work every night. We were comfortably off, but our quality of life was poor. Our physical, our mental, and our spiritual health were suffering, and we recognized the need for change. We were on holiday in Cornwall, sitting on a hill, and I said to Robert, "We're not coming down from this hill until we've decided what we're going to do with our lives. We can't carry on like this," and he agreed. So we prayed, and we sat there and we waited. And the answer came through quite clearly: work together. But how? What? What could we do? We had completely different careers. We went back to work and we waited for 3 years. We searched, we prayed, we listened, we waited. And then in 1998, we saw an advert in the paper, in the Church Times, and they were looking for a couple who were required to manage a big house in Dorset for a Christian charity that provided holidays for people in their care, people with learning difficulties and physical disabilities. And they also provided holidays for full-time Christian workers and ministers of the church. So we applied, and to our astonishment, we were given an interview, and against strong competition, to our further astonishment, we were offered the job. And we accepted. It would mean a huge drop in salary, but it provided a living for us, which means it gave us our accommodation and it would pay for all of our utility bills. And so by faith, we gave in our notice, we gave up our careers, we sold the family home, and we moved here to Dorset, just across the water on the Isle of Purbeck. We had no choice. God had called, and we had responded in obedience. But we felt free. That's what Isaiah 6:8 can do. The Holy Spirit had truly reordered our priorities, so that we could fully experience God's purpose and his abundance. It was wonderful. So at the same time, our son, James, was settling down. He was in the process of buying his first house. But our daughter, Louise, was also experiencing a similar upheaval in her lives to that which we'd been experiencing. She also felt called. Maybe in her case, not by God, but she felt that she wanted to give something back. She'd graduated from university in 1991, and she'd gone straight into a high-flying and very demanding career. But after 7 years of working in the corporate world, she applied successfully to VSO, Voluntary Service Overseas. And in the same month that our lives had been turned upside down, February 1998, she flew out to Indonesia on a 2-year contract. Now, we've got a map here of the world. You can see where we are, I hope, where England is. And Indonesia is right over the other side of the world, just touching on Australia, 8,000 miles away. It's estimated that there are between 13 and 17,000 islands in Indonesia. Nobody's been able to count them all. But if you overlaid the map of Indonesia on top of a map of Europe, it would stretch, Indonesia would stretch from the west coast of Ireland right the way across to Turkey. So it's a very diverse country, a very complex country of fascinating culture and history. It also happens to be the biggest Muslim have the biggest Muslim population in the world. So Louise flew out to Indonesia, and Java, where she was, is the long island towards the bottom. The letter I of Indonesia comes in the middle of Java. Java is 650 miles long. She was at the western end of it in Jakarta, the capital. On her arrival, she went to a reception at the British Embassy, and there she met the British ambassador, Robin Christopher. And I do mean Robin Christopher, not Christopher Robin, that you've probably all heard of. Robin Christopher, yes, that's right. He was a British ambassador. And he took a keen interest in VSO because he'd been a volunteer himself. And he offered Louise help if ever she needed it. Well, she went off on an 8-week language course, and she picked the language up very quickly, which in a way was a disadvantage to her because she'd wanted to go and work on a small island, perhaps on a women's project or with small children. But because she'd picked the language up so quickly, she had her placement at the University of Surabaya. Surabaya is at the far end of Indonesia, the far eastern end. And whereas Jakarta is a very cosmopolitan city, Surabaya is very Islamic. And when Louise reached the university, she was the only Westerner on the whole of the campus. She was also the only Westerner in the whole of the area where she was living. But thanks to Robin Christopher, she was given an introduction to the British consulate, and she went in Surabaya, and she went along there, and she became very friendly with the British consul's wife, Oni. She also made a lot of friends amongst the female Muslim lecturers. And then there's Louise on her little motorbike. That's what she used to zip about on. And she traveled from her little bungalow to the university on that every day. Well, the weeks went by, and we all seemed to be settling into our new ways of life. Robert and I with our ministry at the Christian charity that we were working for. Our son had settled into his house, and Louise was getting on very well at the university and with the Indonesian language and people. And then one evening, Robert and I switched the television on to settle down and watch the BBC News. And the headlines were alarming. Violence had erupted in Indonesia. We'd been aware of political unrest for some time, but it had come to a head. President Suharto was a very oppressive military dictator, and this had led to anarchy amongst the people and the formation of several new political parties, which in turn led to uprisings and, in short, a revolution. There were protests and rallies, demonstrations, and these escalated into fighting and bloodshed on the streets. And the two epicenters were Jakarta and, of course, Surabaya, where Louise was. So you can imagine how we were feeling watching these scenes unfold night after night on the BBC News, on the television. The army was brought in as the chaos worsened, and there was looting, food shortages, the economy collapsed, and the currency was devalued overnight. Transport and communication links broke down, the schools closed, and the universities closed, and we'd had no word through all this time from Louise. We didn't have mobile phones in those days, social media, Facebook, anything like that. We'd had no word. As the days wore on, our anxieties heightened, and all we could do was pray that the Lord would keep Louise safe and watch over her. We could just trust. And then one evening the phone rang, and praise God, it was Louise. She was safe. She told us that when the army tanks had started assembling at the end of her road, she knew that it was time to get out. So she fled to the British consulate, and the British consul and his wife took her in. She was safe. Or so we thought. A few days later on our television screens, we saw the British embassy in Jakarta being stormed. What would this mean for the British consulate in Surabaya? We didn't know. We didn't hear anything. 36 hours went by, and then we had another phone call from Louise. The British consul had been told by the Foreign Office to leave, to get out of the British consulate and to go to a safe house. And taking his wife, his family, and Louise with him, they took over the two top floors of the Hilton Hotel, the International Hilton Hotel in Surabaya. And Louise actually found herself living in a suite. A bit of a contrast. They then ran an evacuation program from those top two floors of the International Hilton Hotel to evacuate the British nationals who were living in Indonesia at the time. The British consul, his wife, family, and Louise had a helipad on the roof, so they had an escape route should it be needed. Louise assisted with interpretation and working on the switchboard. Well, the situation, the political unrest, call it what you like, the revolution, continued on for several weeks. But over time, the political situation began to settle. President Suharto was overthrown, and a woman, the first woman president, was elected. Her name was Megawati. Life began to return to normal, and Louise returned to her little bungalow and to the university, which reopened. And then came my next calling, this time from Louise. "Mum, I need you, please come." Well, it was August 1998 by now. We'd signed a contract with the charity we were working for that we wouldn't take our leave during the high season, the holiday season. But this was August, it was the high holiday season. Robert, my husband, had not been in the best of health himself for some months, and I was torn. Obviously, my child was calling. I wanted to go to her. So, of course, I prayed. And after a restless night, a very unsettled night, it was obvious that I had to go. The Lord was telling me, yes, you must go to Indonesia. My passport was all up to date. I'd had all my jabs, because Robert and I had had a lovely holiday in the Far East a couple of years before. So everything was pointing towards me going, and Robert assured me that he would manage on his own, that he could manage our job together. And he assured me that I wasn't exactly going on holiday, I was taking leave for a very special reason. And so I went, I got my ticket. The evening before I went to Indonesia was a Sunday. Robert and I went to church as usual, and when we were there, we sang, "I, the Lord of Sea and Sky." The words of Isaiah 6:8 spoke forcibly to me, and I knew without doubt that it was right for me to go. It was Monday. Robert dropped me off at Bournemouth interchange, and I caught the coach from Bournemouth to Heathrow. As soon as the wheels of the coach started turning, that song started turning in my head. It carried me. Throughout the 12-hour flight to Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, that song stayed with me. As I flew over oceans, through the sky, "I, the Lord of Sea and Sky," was playing over and over again, and it was strengthening. There was an 8-hour time difference, so although I landed in Malaysia at 6 o'clock in the morning on the Tuesday in this country, it was already early afternoon in Malaysia. I had a 2-hour wait at the airport, and then I transferred onto another plane and flew another 2 hours on to Jakarta. Again, I, the Lord of sea and sky, carrying me on. I could really feel God's presence. I knew I was doing the right thing. I knew I was safe. I knew all would be well. I arrived in Jakarta on the Tuesday evening and made my way to my accommodation, my overnight accommodation. And the next day found myself on the huge station at Jakarta looking for the train to take me to Surabaya, 650 miles away, a 9-hour train journey. And again, on that train journey, throughout, I, the Lord of sea and sky, staying in my head. And you know, sometimes when you get a song in your head and you just want to try and shake it off, it wasn't like that at all. I didn't want to let it go because it was really reminding me of God's presence and giving me courage. And then I arrived in Surabaya, and there on the platform, scrambling onto the train, pushing past all the people who were trying to get off, was my daughter, Louise. And joyful doesn't, it just doesn't really, it doesn't say how that, it doesn't explain how that reunion was. It doesn't sum it up. It was joyful, joyful. And then we followed by three exciting days. Of course, Louise wanted me to go to the university to meet her fellow colleagues, to meet some of her students. And there I am with some of the lovely Muslim ladies. I met the British consul's wife, Oni, of course, and thanked her for looking after Louise, for befriending her as she had. And what I hadn't known, what Louise hadn't told her father and I, was that Louise had been very ill after the revolution had finished. She'd had some kind of tropical fever, and Oni had nursed her. She'd been living at the consulate during that time. She was also suffering with what I suppose today we'd call PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, disorder. But she was fine. We were together. And the British consul's wife, bless her, put her car and her chauffeur at our disposal, and we went about for two or three fun-filled whirlwind days here, there, and everywhere. On the Saturday evening, back at Louise's little bungalow, she then said to me, "You need to pack your rucksack again, Mum, because we're off to Sulawesi tomorrow." "Sulawesi?" I said, "Where's that? Why?" Well, as well as lecturing at the university, Louise was also, she's quite unstoppable, my daughter, she was also training up to be a field officer with VSO, which meant that she would be going out to visit the other volunteers, wherever they might be in Indonesia, whenever they needed help or support. And she would go along to visit them and give them that support. And there was a volunteer on the island of Sulawesi who was in need of support himself. So she was going to go. She also told me that it was the Festival of the Dead in Sulawesi at that time, which she thought would be particularly interesting to me because I'm quite interested in that sort of thing. But that's another story for another time, maybe, but possibly not Songs of Praise. It's very gruesome. And so we were setting off to Sulawesi. There's a map of Sulawesi. It lies just to the east of Borneo, between Borneo and Papua New Guinea, actually. I see Sienna here. Sienna will be on her way to Papua New Guinea very soon. The equator runs through Sulawesi east-west, right through the middle. The Wallace Line runs through Sulawesi north-south, right through the middle. Just wait for that. The Wallace Line is where the intercontinental plates of Australia and Asia overlap. So there's a wonderful and amazing diversity of flora and fauna. There's more than 150 mammals live on Sulawesi, mammals that you'd normally find in places like Australia and Asia. There's certainly more birds than that, and certainly more snakes and spiders. The spiders are big. Nature is fierce in Sulawesi. The climate is fierce, hot, humid, wet. It is extreme, and that's where we were going. And we were going to go to a place, can you see where the mountains are in the middle? We were going to a place called Tana Toraja. That's the name of the region, which means land of the mountains. And we were going to go to a village called Rantapau, which was right in the middle of Tana Toraja. It's landlocked and it's very remote. And the tribespeople there had been headhunters until 1902, when Dutch missionaries had arrived, bringing Christianity with them. They introduced the Bible there in 1913. So you've got a pocket of Christian people in the middle of this otherwise huge Islamic country. So very early on the Sunday morning, we set out and we flew in a very small plane from Surabaya to Bali. And yes, you've guessed that song. It started up again in my head, "Hide the Lord of Sea and Sky." It wasn't going to go away. We landed at Bali, waited a while, and then we flew on an even smaller plane. It only carried 8 people. Felt like it was made of paper and balsa wood. It probably wasn't, but it felt like that. And Louise and I were sitting behind the pilot, so we had a pretty good view, and it was absolutely wonderful flying quite low over turquoise waters. "I, the Lord of Sea and Sky," in my head. We landed on an airstrip in a place called Ujang Pandang, only to discover that we'd missed the only bus of the day, and we had a 200-mile journey ahead of us. What were we going to do? Undeterred, Louise said, "Don't worry, I'll sort something out. You wait here with the rucksacks." And off she went. She hadn't been gone long when back she came. "I found a rice farmer." Okay. He's just made a huge delivery of rice. He's got an empty open truck. He's driving back to Tana Toraja, and we can sit on the empty rice sacks in the back. Right, okay, 200 miles on roughshod dirt track roads. Didn't sound too appealing. But what did make it appealing was the beautiful scenery that we were driving through. It must have been like the Garden of Eden, how that must have looked. It was sublime, nature at its best. So with that and this Garden of Eden scenery and "I, the Lord of Sea and Sky" happening in my head, I enjoyed the journey. Night falls very quickly on the equator, and by 6 o'clock in the evening, it was dark. So the last hour or so of our journey was in pitch black. We went through the mountain pass, and there we were in this landlocked place. When the driver pulled up and said, "We are here now," which didn't seem very likely because it just seemed to me as though we were in the middle of nowhere. I think, Tanya, there we are. That's what we were in the middle of, paddy fields. And that's what they look like in the daytime. But we were there, remember, it's pitch black. But he pointed out a light to us in the distance and he said, "Rantapau." Okay. The bullfrogs, the cicadas were making a din. So we set off, rucksacks on our back, Louise's little torch, navigating our way between these rice paddy fields and along a little narrow ledge. And somehow or other, we got through safely and we came to a track leading to the village. A little drink here. This is a bit where it gets exciting, if it wasn't exciting enough. The light that we had seen came from a church. We could make out the shape of the building. Being a Sunday, there was a service and the doors of the church were open and we could see in. We could see right down to the end of the little aisle. We could see the minister standing in front of the altar and a cross on the wall behind him. The only difference in that church was that all the men were sitting on one side and all the women were sitting on the other. And then some music started up. I find it difficult to say this, but it was absolutely true. People started singing, "I, the Lord of Sea and Sky." I went down on my knees on the dirt in front of the church. I can remember Louise, she was so worried. Mum, Mummy, you all right? She didn't know what was happening. She hadn't heard me singing this in my head all the way there. And I'm saying to her, they're singing I, the Lord of Sea and Sky. And she said, yes, yes. And she got me up and we went and we sat at the back of the church. If ever I'd needed confirmation, affirmation that there was a God, this was it. My God was their God, our God, a worldwide, a universal God. There he was amongst the least reached people of the world in this remote place. He got there before me because he was already there. He's everywhere. It was just absolutely, utterly amazing. And the next few several days were just filled with his presence, sometimes in the strangest of ways, because I've mentioned this Festival of the Dead that we went to, and it was a kind of Christianity, but it was mixed with animism and the animistic faith of the people. But he was there. He was there in our accommodation. There's Louise in our little outdoor bathroom, the jungle behind us. You might just be able to see that. And there we are outside the village where we were staying. And there's Louise. You can see the little church in the background there. There she is in the village. Just a little church, but one big God. He's there. He's here. He's a faithful God. He's in here. All we have to do is respond, "Here I am, Lord," and then prepare to be amazed.